Well, good morning again, everybody. It's lovely to be back here again, second week in a row. As I mentioned last week, I decided to speak to you a bit more personally and reflectively over these 2 weeks. And knowing that today was Aboriginal Sunday, I thought an appropriate thing to talk about would be the things that I've learnt from Aboriginal people. As we've heard, today is Aboriginal Sunday, and I acknowledge that I speak today as the descendant of white settlers, a beneficiary of the colonisation of British people, who took the land and much more from the First Nations peoples. Therefore, I pay my respects to the elders and the people of the Kulin Nations, descendants of those who cared for this place that we're meeting on today, this gift of God to them and us. I am not Aboriginal. I have spent most of my life, in fact, ignoring the perspective of Indigenous people while working in God's mission in foreign places, particularly in India. But in recent years, as I mentioned last week, I had opportunity through my work at Tear Fund to interface with First Nations groups around the country and to support them with some of TIER's funds. And all those years taught me how little I really understood them. And I cringe now as I think about all the mistakes I made in my interactions with Indigenous people. The past decade, therefore, since I left TIER, has been a time of repentance for me, learning how the world looks from a different perspective. So I offer you these thoughts now today with humility, acknowledging that they are my own journey and possibly not yours. About 8 years ago, a small group was formed at our church, our little Anglican church in Spotswood. We decided that we wanted to listen and learn from Aboriginal people in the hope that we could begin to see the world, God and faith through different eyes. We call it the Learning Circle. And we decided to take responsibility for our own learning and growth and not expect Aboriginal people to come and do it for us or to be necessarily always available to us. So since that time, over the last 8 years, we've met monthly, working our way through books and audio stories from Indigenous people. The effect on me has been profound. I am a Bible scholar. I immerse myself in the Bible as a daily practice and have learned much. But try as I might, I can never shake off the lens of reading as a white Western woman. And while I like to think that I'm reading the Bible on its own terms, with its original meaning, what I'm really doing is reading through my own lens. I can't help but do that. But what happens when I listen to Aboriginal people is that I begin to see different ways of thinking about Bible stories. And it reminds me, therefore, of my own cultural assumptions and some of my cultural arrogance. What do I mean by this? So I want to give you some examples today. And I will use some of the text from a little book written by a woman called Ambulin Kwemalina, a little book called Living on Stolen Land. It's the book in the middle of the screen there, to illustrate this and to show you some of the things I've learnt. The first thing I had to do was let go of my assumption that God only arrived in Australia when the first fleet arrived. Of course God was active in this land. Of course. God does not create and leave. God does not set and forget. God was here with Aboriginal people long before we white fellas arrived. God is always reaching out in and through the created world. Aboriginal people tell me that they know the land as kin. So what would it be like to look around every landscape and regard everything that you're seeing, hills, rocks, watercourses, plants and people, as kin? Quemelina says, there is no part of this place that was not, is not, cared for and loved by an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander nation. There are no trees, rivers, hills, stars that were not and are not someone's kin. This crucial insight, I think, is related to something the Bible has been trying to teach us as well. Genesis 2:15. It tells us that humanity was put into that garden to serve it and to observe it. In other words, learn from it. Watch its ways and learn. Just as Aboriginal people have been trying to teach us all this time. In 2012, as part of my work at TIER, I visited a piece of coastline near Port Stephens in New South Wales that had recently been handed back to Aboriginal mob. It was a parcel of coastal fringe that previously had been the place where large, noisy vehicles drove up and down, crushing everything under their wheels. Now, some years later, it was a serene place. The Aboriginal ranger showed me around, pointing out with pride the renewed ponds, the insect life, the frogs and the lizards, the birds that were visiting, the recovering plant life. He said to me, "The land is happy that it's come back to us." Aboriginal people teach me a much more personal world, a world in which humans are just one part of an integrated web of life. And we lose sight of that at our peril. The next thing I've learnt is that nothing can be done without building relationships first. Quemelina says, the how is more important than the what. We are partners on pathways to all the knowledges, inventions, joys, and wonders that come out of respectful relationships. When TIER began its Indigenous program, we decided the first thing we needed to do was develop a reconciliation action plan. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with these, but organisations will often develop a plan to show how the organisation as a whole intends to relate to the Aboriginal people around them. The aim of it was to make the TIER staff more sensitive and well-informed, and to make sure we weren't doing things for Aboriginal people, but with them as well. So I set about writing these wonderful things, beautiful but meaningless plans about what TIER could do. Until Uncle Dennis Atkinson, a Yorta Yorta man, and Grant Paulson, whom I know some of you will know, came alongside me and reminded me that nothing could be done until I stopped and worked with them. Seems so obvious now to me, but it wasn't obvious then when I had deadlines and targets to meet. And that was a really hard lesson for me because I'm a person focused on getting things done. Quemelina says, listening means giving time and space for Indigenous people to decide what we want to share, on what terms we want to share it, and if we want to share it at all. So I stopped trying to do it myself. I formed an advisory group of wise Indigenous people, and finally we were able to proceed. And TIER, I think, was the first Christian NGO, certainly in Melbourne, possibly across the country, to develop such a reconciliation plan. The third and probably most important thing that I've learnt is to acknowledge the damage that colonisation has done and that it continues to do. Kwemalina says, two different worlds now exist in the same space, and there is no place of innocence for settlers to stand. Not one location where settlers do not benefit, do not inherit the benefits of violent dispossession of those who were here before. My great-grandfather bought land on the Koroit Creek in what is now Sunshine, in those days known as Braybrook Junction, to build a small factory workshop. But not once ever in my childhood did I ever hear of any agreement or settlement with the local Aboriginal people. And a few years ago, I went on a guided walk along the Koroit Creek, which had been a camping place and a pathway, a virtual freeway, if you like, for Aboriginal people to get from one area to another. And all along the Koroit Creek, we were finding little things that reminded us of Aboriginal people, little axe heads and various things. There was quite a treasure trove there. But in all my childhood in Sunshine, I met no Aboriginal person nor knew anything of that big dispossession that had taken place on the western plains of Melbourne. We worship at a church in Spotswood, and there's been an Anglican church on the site for over 130 years. And I expect it was, like many Anglican churches, a grant of land from the government for the setting up of a place of worship. Williamstown, of course, was the earliest settlement in Melbourne. But interestingly, there's never been any acknowledgement of that fact in our church until recently, until we started to think about the problem. And from then on, we've been making acknowledgement of the land that we worship on. Now, as an Old Testament scholar, I'm uncomfortable when I read in books like Joshua of the violent dispossession of Canaan by the people of Israel. In 2013, the Reverend Graham Paulson, whom I'm sure many of you know, wrote a paper following a story-weaving conference at Whitley College. And in the paper, he gives his reflections on Joshua and on various parts of the Old Testament. And he focused on the stories that showed respect for Indigenous peoples in the land of Canaan. And one example was the story that was read to us this morning by Christina, with all of those hard words in it. Thank you, Christina. It's the story, of course, when Abram met with the king of Salem, Melchizedek, and paid him tithe, showing respect for this indigenous priest king, not trying to oust him, replace him, or convert him. And there are other texts too that show that respect for indigenous people. Abraham insisted on buying a piece of land from a Hittite person, Ephron, a native of the land of Canaan, so that he could bury wife Sarah in a land that was not his own. And Joshua himself, despite all the language and rhetoric of conquest and takeover, made covenants of protection with local peoples, such as the Gibeonites. The fact is, when you look very closely at the Old Testament, the Hebrew tribes lived peaceably among indigenous groups in Canaan and shared the land with them. Although Graham Paulson focused on Old Testament passages, we can also see signs of this respect in the New Testament. Now, people in Palestine, of course, as you well know, were under the domination of the Roman Empire and subject to their rules. And yet, Paul stood up in the Areopagus that day in Athens and boldly reminded his hearers that From one ancestor, God made all nations to inhabit the earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places they would live. Well, put that in your pipe, Romans. They were going to be subject always to God's ways and God's timing. In the same way, from the start of our settlement in Port Phillip, little acknowledgement was made of Indigenous dispossession. 30 years after the founding of Melbourne in 1835, so damaging had colonisation been that only about 200 people of the Kulin Nations, once much larger than that, remained. And from that original injustice stems all the pain of Aboriginal people, and it won't end until we get the courage to fess up and make our amends. Graham Paulson is just one example of what we can learn from Aboriginal people's ways of reading the Bible. Another example is Uncle Ray Minicon, who's spoken and written about how he reads the book of Job. He identifies Job with Aboriginal people. He thinks Aboriginal people are just like Job in protesting their innocence to God against the devastating loss of all that's meaningful to them. When I began work in the Indigenous program at TIER, I travelled to meet leaders of projects, and I was shocked to find how many of them had chronic illnesses, mental and physical. Their work was so often interrupted by significant medical procedures and unexpected medical events, or funerals of family members who died too young. That was a wake-up call for me, and I soon learnt that these symptoms that the Aboriginal peoples that I worked with had are symptoms of dispossessed groups all around the world. Indigenous people around the world suffer similar levels of disadvantage, of ill health, and so on. From Native Americans to Hmong people in the Southeast Asia, various displaced tribes in India. Yet within this malaise of the effects of colonisation, I found that there was a strength and resilience that brought Aboriginal people back again and again. So in Aboriginal people, I see this truth about the gospel embodied, that God's strength is best revealed in weakness, that the gospel is revealed in humility, that the first will be last and the last first. Jesus was executed by an oppressive imperial power on behalf of all. Aboriginal Christians cling to this truth that God is present among them, among the powerless, those in prison, those who are sick. When we lived in Alice Springs, we sometimes joined the team that went out to Alice Springs prison on Sunday afternoons to have a service and a time with any prisoners who wanted it. The churches in Alice Springs took it in turns on a rotation basis to go out there. It was a very, very moving time every time we went there, because at the end of a short informal service, we would invite the inmates in the prison into some private prayer if they wished with any of the team members. I should say that 95% of the inmates of Alice Springs prison are Indigenous, and the population of Alice Springs is about 30% Indigenous. That number of people, the 95%, is not because they are more wicked than the rest of us, but just because of the chain of negative behaviours nurtured by extreme disadvantage. So in this prison, a huge, treeless, crowded, incredibly hot compound, many, in fact probably most, of the men and women that we interacted with would line up in the sun in order to have one of us pray privately with them. And in hushed voices, they would tell us about their court cases and share their concern for their children and their families. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Uncle Ray Minicon loves the book of Job because at the end of the book, at the end of all Job's anguish, God takes Job back to the beginning of Genesis, to the created, good, pre-fall world. Ray Minicon says, "To me, Job is an Aboriginal story. It seems like it's when we've lost everything of value, everything we treasure, all our possessions, all that we see as important, that we finally have eyes to see God." Uncle Ray suggests that a lot of our theology starts from Genesis 3 and majors on human sin and the need for redemption. But he notes that Genesis 1 offers a different starting point, the goodness of God and the created world. So you're probably getting the idea now that I see that First Nations people are a great gift to us. Their ways of seeing and knowing have so much to teach us, and yet their communities are so damaged by their encounter with white settlement. And it staggers me that there is so much grace from them, despite all that I represent. William Cooper, who began Aboriginal Sunday many years ago, a Christian Yorta Yorta man, is credited with initiating this day, a day to pray for healing, freedom, and justice for Aboriginal people. He was one of the earliest First Nations people organising for land rights and for representation in Parliament. He had a generosity of spirit that made him sensitive to oppression everywhere. In 1938, he led a delegation to the Consul General of the Third Reich, based in Melbourne, protesting against the cruel persecution of the Jewish people by the Nazi government of Germany. I often ponder that and think what it must have taken for someone with up to his eyeballs in trying to fight for land rights here to turn his attention to the plight of the Jews. Of course, that was even before World War I and what we knew about the concentration camps. So how do we begin to make reparation for all that? Although the invitation of First Nations peoples in the Uluru Statement was crushed by the loss of the Voice plebiscite last year, some state governments around Australia are proceeding in really positive ways, and Victoria actually is one of them. We have conducted the truth-telling Yuruk Commission to set the record straight. And the Victorian government is also embarking on forms of treaty, working with representative Aboriginal groups. Some individuals I know pay a proportion of their council rates on their home to Indigenous causes. And some churches are beginning to do the same. At the instigation of the Learning Circle, the parish council at our Spotswood Anglican Church decided a couple of years ago to gradually work toward an annual reparation payment to Indigenous people of about 10% of the church's rental income. And this year we will get up to 7.5%, and that's a bit over $10,000. That is really going to hurt. Yet we are committed to it, the parish council is committed to it, even though it is going to be difficult and things will have to change in some ways. But this is our attempt to enact the spirit of Matthew 5, that when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother and sister, and then come and offer your gift. Amen.